This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Bankers rarely win popularity contests, but right now they may be America's least favorite fat cats. As billions of taxpayer dollars go to major banks, fewer and fewer people qualify for loans. Credit limits on bank credit cards dwindle, rates and fees shoot up. Bankers give themselves bonuses, reward employees with trips to Vegas. One redecorates his office to the tune of $1.2 million. Last week, President Obama sent a harsh shame-on-you message to Wall Street and capped senior executive salaries at $500,000 for firms that take federal help. And tomorrow, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner announces the Obama administration's bank rescue plan, which is likely to provoke as much controversy as the last one. Today, we're asking you, what do you want from your bank? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Later on in the program, on the opinion page, why Wall Street bankers might find it hard to get by on $500,000 per. But first, joining us from member station KNPR, Binyamin Applebaum, who reports on banking for the Washington Post. And nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks very much. And I should mention I'm actually in Vegas at a bankers' convention right now.
What an odd place for a convention of bankers.
Yes, indeed. Gambling all around.
And a lot of people come away from the current crisis, Binyamin, with the impression that this bailout is just terribly unfair on a number of levels. For one thing, the taxpayer money is being used to reward failure.
Well, it is unfair. The problem is, what do you do about that? There's no question that there are problems and that there's unfairness, and pretty much any conceivable solution is going to reward at least some people who don't deserve to be rewarded, whether that's homeowners who took on too much risk, bankers who gave them larger loans than they should have, Wall Street who profited immensely from it. There aren't a lot of heroes right now, and we've got to help someone. So there are a lot of unpalatable choices.
And when we're talking about the hundreds of billions of dollars that got into financial institutions, how many institutions and how much exactly?
How much did the government invest?
Yeah.
It's so far around $200 billion that's been pumped directly into banks in a bid, it was said, to encourage lending has been invested so far. There's another more than $100 billion that's been invested in other financial institutions that had specific problems. That includes Citigroup, it includes the car companies, it includes AIG, the giant insurance company.
And so how come that $200 billion, how come it doesn't seem to be used to give people loans?
Well, that's a great question. And the answer in large part is that it didn't go to banks that were well situated to increase lending. The government came out and said, you know, we're going to do this program. It's going to increase lending. But the banks the money actually went to are generally very weak banks that needed the money to solve problems, to increase their reserves of capital, which banks are required to hold against potential losses. Those reserves had been drained by a lot of real losses, and they needed to be built back up. It went to banks that were acquiring other troubled institutions to help them complete those deals without damaging their own health. And in many cases, banks are just sitting on it. They're holding it in short-term savings, trying to make a little money off of it, and waiting, frankly, for conditions to improve.
And in the meantime, people hope that conditions will improve if people can get loans.
Right. That's the vicious circle. That's exactly right. Everyone's waiting for someone else to solve the problem.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255. What do you want from your bank? Email us talk@npr.org. And why don't we begin with Debbie. Debbie's with us from Chesapeake, Virginia.
Hi. In the 80s, I actually worked for a savings and loan that was taken over by the federal government. They came in on Friday, and we reopened on Monday, and everything continued. People paid the bills, and the investors lost their money, and the managers were out of jobs. But my question is, the FDIC is in place. Why not just let the federal government go in, take over those bad banks, put new management in place, and then sell the assets or do what needs to be done? It seems to me like that would be a better fix than just pumping money into the banks when they're not doing what this money's supposed to be doing.
Binyamin Applebaum, those who live by the invisible hand ought to be able to die by the invisible hand, it seems to me, is what Debbie is saying.
It's a great question, and there's a couple points to make. The first is that the government has seized several institutions in recent months. Washington Mutual the largest failed bank in American history. IndyMac Bancorp, a major California mortgage lender, both were taken over in much the manner the caller describes, and then sold to new investors, cleaned up somewhat and sold to new investors. So that is happening. The problem is that the government doesn't want to run the banking system. It wants to keep as many of these institutions in business as possible, because senior government officials believe that bankers are better at running banks than they are, because they lack the resources to do this on a really large scale. And most of all, because they're concerned that every time you seize a bank, and we certainly saw this fall, every time you seize one of these institutions, investors at healthier institutions start to panic. The health of those institutions deteriorates. All of a sudden, the list of banks you might have to seize is a lot longer than you'd hoped.
Debbie?
I still don't see why they don't do this. I think what they did with Washington Mutual and stuff seemed to work out profitably for the taxpayers.
All right.
It worked out sort of profitably for the taxpayers. The problem is that it's a huge hole in the economy when a bank fails. It pulls a lot of lending out of communities. Washington Mutual is a shadow of its former self in terms of its role in the economy. There are a lot of consequences when banks fail, and regulators are trying to avoid those consequences as much as possible.
But the issue is the banks made bad decisions, and they don't seem to be paying for it. We as taxpayers seem to be paying for these bad decisions.
Let's bring another voice in to help us answer that question. And that's Diane Casey Landry, who's with us here in Studio 3A. She's the Chief Operating Officer of the American Bankers Association. And nice of you to come in to speak with us today.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
And can you help Debbie out with her question?
Well, I think we would tell you that, first of all, there aren't as many bad banks out there as you all think. I mean, if you're talking about Bear Stearns, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, AIG, those are the institutions that went down. But the banks and the CPP program, which is what has been talked about, the capital purchase program, mm-hmm. was an investment program intended for healthy banks. And so they took a look and they made sure that the banks that they were investing the money into had the capital, and it was to bolster the capital position and to get lending jump started. And I would tell you from our numbers, as well as from outside analysts, that lending has increased.
Has increased, but people are still having a hard time getting loans. Just let me read this email. This is from Elizabeth in Tucson, Arizona. And Debbie, by the way, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. This is from Elizabeth in Tucson, Arizona. Credit card companies have increased my interest rate, even though I'm not delinquent. As a result, I'm not spending. I'm merely paying off my credit cards. If I do not accept their higher rates, I'll lose the credit card. In this environment, it is catch-22, as I'm terrified of their ability to eliminate my credit line. These credit card companies are all receiving bailout monies. I am therefore supporting them and forced to pay higher rates.
Well, first, let's clarify who has received funds. There's only been 359 banks. There's 8,300 banks in this country. Only at this point in time, 359 have actually received CPP funds. And before you start lending it, you need to get deposits. You don't get a dollar of capital and turn around and make it into a dollar of loan. If you get a dollar of capital, then you go out and you raise deposits and you leverage it. Ideally, you could maybe get up to $7 in new loans. And so the point is that deposits have not been flowing. From our perspective, when you take a look at what happened 30 years ago, banks controlled 60% of all lending. The problem is that people confuse what's a bank today. People talk about Bear Stearns as being a bank. They talk about the mortgage banks or AIG. They're not banks. Today, banks control about 30% of the lending. And in the last 3 months, it's gone up significantly in terms of the amount of lending that banks are doing. But we can't make up in 3 months disintermediation in terms of the loans that were left this system over the past 30 years.
But specifically on the credit cards, those are Bank of America, those are Chase, those are banks.
Well, what they're doing in terms of we're pricing for risk. I mean, there's definitely a risk correlation with respect to what the rates are. And the point is that a prudent borrower should be looking at what their obligations are and can they afford to repay it. And the reality is that in this environment, based on the loss levels, each time someone files for bankruptcy or doesn't repay their loan, the loss levels go up and that goes to a pricing.
These people are repaying.
That doesn't mean that you can't price for a borrower. Does your credit situation always stay the same? You have to take a look at the borrower and make sure that they can, in fact, afford to repay, and you're pricing for the risk to that borrower.
Benjamin Applebaum, as I'm sure you're hearing the same howls of outrage from your readers as we're hearing from our listeners.
It's very interesting because, you know, the government investments have transformed a lot of people's perception of their relationship with their banks. It seems more legitimate to be angry at an institution now that you feel on some level like a shareholder in it through the government. People feel like these banks have an obligation to behave differently than they were behaving previously. And one of the real frustrations here is that this crisis in part is a result of the fact that banks made lending too easy. There were too many loans made. Credit was too available. I think one of the very frustrating things as we go through this contraction is for people to confront the reality that it is not going to be as easy to get loans in the future. And frankly, that there's probably nothing the government can do right now to increase lending. Federal Reserve statistics show that lending contracted by 1% in the last quarter of the year. It contracted even faster at the banks that got federal funding. We are not going to turn this around in a second, and people are going to be confronting for a while the reality that it is not as easy to get money from your bank.
Can I add something to that?
Diane Casey-Landry, go ahead.
I would tell you that lending actually increased 1.4%. And while the same statistic that Binya just used is one that we also came up with, you have to affect for what happened, what the banks did between September 10th and October 22nd, when all of Wall Street seized up and banks extended some $345 billion of loans to each other. If you reduce that and then you do a comparison and showing lending overall has increased by about 1%. Not a lot. And he is absolutely right. The lending terms are tighter. It is a more difficult market. But one thing people have to remember is that now you're dealing with banks. A year ago, someone would say they wanted to get a loan. They'd go talk to their mortgage broker. They'd go talk to Wall Street. They would talk to an investment banker. But now you're going into the bank. They went to these other sources because they thought they could get easier credit. If you went to the bank, they were going to make a more difficult decision. They were going to actually underwrite that loan. If you underwrite the loan, you might not have gotten the same rate because the banks will charge you for the risk that you impose. And so the reality is that the non-bank lenders have exited the business. It's going back to the banks, and it's going to the insured depository institutions, and it's a different game.
And I'm sure you're right in what you say, but we all remember, we have to go to a break, just, but we all remember that, you know, pets getting credit card offers and that sort of thing, and those are from, excuse me, banks. So we'll get back to that when we come back from a break. Our guests are Diane Casey-Landry. I didn't mean to put you on the spot and go to the break, but I'll give you the first chance when we get back. I apologize. Our other guest is Binyamin Applebaum, a banking reporter for The Washington Post. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When the federal government poured hundreds of billions into banks, many taxpayers expected better access to loans and lower rates in return. In many cases, the opposite happened. Tomorrow, we'll get details of the latest bailout proposal. What do you want from your bank? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Our guests are Binyamin Applebaum, Washington Post banking reporter, and Diane Casey-Landry, chief operating officer at the American Bankers Association, whom I left on the hook just before the break, and I do apologize for that. But yes, we do remember moments when bank credit cards were being offered, it seemed, to anybody living or dead.
Well, I think there are some practices that have changed, and I think there was a loosening of credit that has certainly tightened up, and we're going to see a different world going forward. And unfortunately, when you have tighter credit, that means not every borrower is qualified to get that loan or that credit card.
Okay. This email from Brett in Boise. The recent media stories about trips to Las Vegas can be a net that catches otherwise hardworking rank-and-file employees who actually earn the privilege of a company-paid trip with some work sales motivation attached. To characterize all such trips as for fat cats is to disservice to hardworking employees who otherwise may not receive recognition above and beyond their regular daily contributions to the work at hand. I think that trip is Wells Fargo, and it's to Las Vegas, where Binyamin Applebaum is now. And that's certainly the explanation that Wells Fargo made when they took out full-page ads yesterday in the Washington Post and the New York Times.
You know, it's a real interesting thing for this industry to be confronting new expectations and living under a microscope they haven't previously lived under. Wells Fargo is a company that's had a lot of problems adjusting to the spotlight it's now under. A lot of its peers also are having those problems, things that seem completely legitimate in the context of normal industry behavior are suddenly transformed by the situation in which we find ourselves. I'd just note that there are a lot of actually very hardworking bankers here this week trying to figure out how to revive their industry. It's by no means a party. The atmosphere is quite grim, actually.
Well, let's go to John. John with us on the line from St. John in the Virgin Islands.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thanks so much for taking the call. And I'd like to address the banking industry as regards credit card rates. I, as well as most Americans, I think, are completely outraged at the higher interest rates that are being charged on credit cards, even under these tough economic times. And in my situation with Capital One, I'd lost a job for 4 months. And during that four-month period, I'd continue to make my credit card payments, albeit two of those payments were 2 days late each. My interest rate went from 9.9% to 23.9%, and it is now non-negotiable for at least 12 months. And I consider that to be an actual punitive measure that should be eliminated by the stimulus package. I believe the bank should be capped at a maximum of 9.9% interest during these tough economic times until everything stabilizes, people get back on their feet, their jobs stabilize. This is ridiculous, charging someone 24% interest on a credit card that they've been a customer for 10 years, and because of two times being late within a 12-month period, according to their policy, now I'm subject to 24% interest for at least 12 months.
And Diane Casey Landry, that to some people, again, you're being put on the defensive, and it's your situation. The 150% increase in rates for being 2 days late twice? You don't work for Capital One, but
I don't work for Capital One, and I'm not going to speak for any individual institution, but I can tell you that the banks use formula pricing, and they base their risk and their pricing models off of the risk that that customer then poses to the institution. I can also tell you that the loans that were being made by the credit card companies, one of the ways they brought the rates down was that they were able to securitize those and sell them into the secondary market. That secondary market no longer exists. Last year it was some $250 billion. It's down to $16 billion today. If they can't fund it and they have to hold it on their books, and that means the standards are going to be that much tighter, and it's going to be more of a restriction of that credit.
And I think I know the answer to this question, but would it be appropriate for the Congress to regulate credit card rates?
I don't think we want Congress regulating any interest rates. I think that's an inappropriate behavior, an inappropriate outcome in terms of regulating interest rates. We're a free market economy, and we think we should be able to set the interest rates that the risk is posed.
Benjamin Applebaum, is that in the cards anywhere?
We had tight restrictions on interest rates for a very long time in America. They were waived as part of the process of deregulating the financial industry. I don't hear anyone seriously talking about reimposing them. And it should be understood that it wouldn't be a complete solution to the problem. If you did impose strict caps on interest rates, you'd drive a lot of lenders out of the market. Again, this is just a process of adjustment to a new reality. There was too much credit. There may be a little bit too little for a while, but a lot of people are going to find the rules of the game have changed.
John, good luck. Thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Roger. Roger calling us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought me in at this point, because I think that Vice President Joe Biden, ex-Senator of Delaware, who has borderline usury rates for credit cards, might be the one that they might want to talk to about changes in their interest rates. But
Delaware has very favorable tax law, so a lot of banks have their headquarters in Delaware.
Because they're uncapped on their interest rates for credit cards.
They also have very favorable tax rates. So, but go ahead, Roger.
Very, very favorable interest rates. Okay.
But go ahead, Roger. Your question.
I have no cap. Okay. Let's talk about the fact that Bernie Madoff. People used to have to beg to invest with him. And I want my local bank to beg for me to invest with it. That way, when you talk about transparency, I know who the bank is lending money to, and I know their ability to repay the loan. And therefore, when you talk about the ability to oversee your investments, local is best. So
you're talking very largely small local banks where would they be fully transparent?
Well, absolutely, because in Wake Forest, North Carolina, we have the Wake Forest Savings and Loan. Guess who they lend to? Local business people. And we know how they're doing, and we'll also be able to oversee their decisions as opposed to sending money off to somebody we trust who in turn sends it off to somebody we don't even know exists, i.e. Bernie Madoff.
Well, you're a long way between the Wake Forest Savings and Loan and Bernie Madoff. But anyway, Benjamin Applebaum, is this a formula that's likely to thrive?
There is a very interesting discussion happening right now about how large banks should be. Right now, our three largest banks each control about 10-11% of the banking industry. Together, they control about a third of it. There are some very good scholars who think that that is too large, that past a certain point, there are not advantages of scale, that you get some of the issues the caller is referencing, where banks are not as functional in helping their communities. There are very good scholars who think that scale has had wonderful advantages for the economy and that we really need even larger banks in order to realize the advantages inherent in that model. This is going to be something we hear a lot more about, this question of how big banks should be.
Let's go now to Janet. Janet with us from Tulsa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, Janet.
Hi. I just recently, about a year ago, got a mortgage with a 15-year limit, and I liked it because my interest rate was low, but I want to extend the length of my, I want to renegotiate it from 15 years to 30 years, and I really can't get through to my bank to talk to them about that. There's various programs that are available through the government, but when I checked into one of them, it just referred me back to a mortgage broker. And, you know, I've got 30 years employment with my company. I'm in a stable job. I've lived in my home for 6 years. If you look at the big picture with me, I'm 52 years old. I'm not going anywhere. I don't want to go anywhere. I want my kids and me to stay in this home. I want to succeed. And for the banks to treat me like I'm some kind of a bad risk because I want to reorganize my finances, I think it's really, really unfair, and this is part of our system.
With respect, Janet, obviously we don't know the specifics of your case, but Diane Casey-Landry, would there be any systemic reason why a bank would be unwilling to talk about renegotiating a 15-year mortgage to a 30-year?
It would be a refinance, and you'd go in and apply, and if you qualify, the bank would be more than willing to talk to you. They're talking to a lot of customers right now. We've heard mortgage volumes up tremendously based on the rates that are out there today.
Because mortgage rates are falling and people are
refinancing. Absolutely, and we encourage you to go in and talk to the bank.
They won't do it because I've missed a payment. I had some medical bills. I've missed a payment. And now because, you know, I'm this bad risk because I've missed a payment. So instead of, you know, working out a deal where the bank and I can succeed, because through my life they've made a lot of money off of me, and that's fine. They've helped me a lot. But now I need to be treated like the individual I am rather than a bad risk because of some mold that I'm supposed to fit into. I want somebody to look at my entire history and
okay.
I was late on a payment this year, so you're a bad risk.
And Benjamin Applebaum, this is something they are talking about. We may find out more about tomorrow from the new Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner.
I think we're going to hear a sort of a sketch of maybe the direction they're headed in on mortgage modifications tomorrow, and then we'll hear more in the coming weeks. But yeah, the government is set to announce some type of broad program to help people modify mortgage loans if they can't afford those loans, to help people avoid foreclosure. I think the caller really describes very well the situation a lot of people find themselves in, the frustration that is inherent in feeling like you've been priced by a model and evaluated by a model, and that your personal characteristics are not getting the attention they deserve. That commoditization of finance is something that made a lot more money available to a lot more people, but we're now seeing the downside to it, the complexity of it as a model.
Janet, good luck.
Well, should I call my senator, or how do I find out about this stuff? Because I really haven't had any success online. I don't know where to turn.
Diane?
I suggest that you actually take a look at the HUD website for Hope for Homeowners, and there's a list of counseling agencies, and go through a housing counseling agency who can help you take a look at your overall finances and then go back to the financial institution.
And HUD is the Housing and Urban Development.
Right.
That's
yeah,
a government
department. It would be HUD.gov, and then Hope for Homeowners.
Well, that's what I did before, but maybe somebody's added something to it since then. I'll go check it out again. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Janet. Here's an email, again, on the same topic from Christine. I want them to treat me fairly. We have a credit score of 760, a lot of equity in our house, even in this economy. No outrageous debt or promises. They still have been stalling since the middle of December, checking this, checking that. They tried to give us a higher percentage rate, and I finally got on the phone with the manager and told them that they can't give us a loan with our excellent credit. Who can they loan to? When we bought our house and started our business 8 years ago, they didn't put us through this much. They didn't even verify employment. We were a good risk, but they didn't know that. They have to loosen up or they will force this perfectly viable small business out of business. And again, Binyamin Applebaum, this is a situation a lot of people find themselves in. And what you're saying is that, in fact, we're all going to have to readjust to a new world.
Yeah, you know, I was talking with a mortgage banking executive this morning who told me that he had been trying to refinance, that he has perfect credit, and that it is taking him months to get through the process. I think that sort of underscores just how difficult it's become. And yeah, you know, some of this is going to go away with time as the economy improves, as the industry, you know, reorganizes itself and gets back up on its feet.
That's good.
Some
to
of
talk
this
to
complexity will get sorted out. Yeah, well, you know, some of it is not. Some of this is never or not in the foreseeable future going to go away. Some of this is a pullback from things that frankly had gone too far. And we are going to have to come to grips with those changes.
Binyamin Applebaum of the Washington Post, also with us, Diane Casey Landry of the American Bankers Association. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Robert. Robert with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, hey. What if we just eliminated the profit motive from our financial institutions entirely and deregulated credit unions so they can issue credit cards and compete openly with banks and just adopt and see how that free market model susses itself out? Because as I see it, banks are beholden neither to their depositors nor to their customers, the people they loan money to, but they only judge their success in what their stock price is or the profit that they can roll over to the people that are just seem to be leeching the system.
Binyamin Applebaum, are credit unions viable competitors to banks?
Credit unions have been picking up a lot of market share. They had a record year in 2008. Their loan volume was the highest in history. A lot of people are turning to credit unions to get loans and to other sources of financing, community institutions and other alternative sources. You know, turning to parents or grandparents for loans, I'm sure, is becoming more common as well.
Of course they are, because credit unions are beholden to their depositors, not their stockholders. So my bank doesn't care about me. If I don't like the deal, they say go to the bank across the street. They give you the same lousy deal. No one is satisfied with their bank. Everyone loves their credit union, but credit unions can't compete openly with banks because of a bunch of arbitrary regulations that I think are imposed upon bank lobbyists. And this is just indicative of big business everywhere not conducting business, but in fact spending all of their money to game the system.
Diane Casey Landry?
Well, I would point out that not every bank is publicly traded. In fact, you have about 700, 800 mutual institutions in this country. You also have what's known as S corporations and privately held banks. We have 8,300 banks in this country, so there's a lot of choice out there and allows you to compete. Credit unions have experienced some of the same difficulties, but I would point out that we've been hearing community banks' numbers have increased dramatically in terms of the amount of lending that they're doing. They are out there seeking loans. They're also seeking deposits. They do value their customers. I think the reality is that it's the relationship. And with respect to credit unions, some of them have had some of the same challenges that the banks have had with respect to the write-down on appraised values of the loans that they've held, as well as their corporate central needing additional funding and actually asking and coming in and asking for some of the TARP funds.
Yeah, but Binyamin Applebaum, Robert gets to a point, which is about accountability. People feel as if somehow these banks are simply not accountable, even when some of them are getting so much money from the federal government.
There is a remarkable amount of anger out there. We hear it all the time. You hear language, frankly. The language the caller was using is extremely striking. It's not language you've heard in American political discourse in quite some time. People talking openly about questions of, you know, how good are corporations? How accountable are they? What role ought they to play in the economy? What alternative models perhaps ought to be unleashed to compete with them? This is a discussion America hasn't had in quite some time. It's really interesting to hear it bubbling up, to hear people thinking about those issues. We are clearly in a moment of great pain and anger, and it will be very interesting to see what comes of it.
Are those issues being discussed there at the banking convention in Las Vegas?
No, I think, you know, the conference here is primarily an industry conference trying to figure out how to get back up on their feet. They continue to believe very deeply in the model that they created. There's a recognition that it went too far in some respects. There's a recognition that they are going to have to submit to greater regulation in the future. But this is primarily a gathering of believers. These are people who believe in the tremendous, what they see as the tremendous benefits that the process of securitization, basically selling loans to investors, brought to Americans by making lending incredibly available, unprecedentedly available. And they're just trying to figure out how to move forward and how to recreate that system. They still believe in it.
Robert, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thanks to Benjamin Applebaum for his time today as he is covering a convention. He assures us is absolutely no fun at all there in Las Vegas. we'll talk to you later. Have a great time.
Thanks very much.
Also, our thanks to Diane Casey Landry, Chief Operating Officer of the American Bankers Association, who joined us here in Studio 3A. We thank you for your patience today.
You're welcome.
Up next, the Talk of the Nation opinion page. You try to live on $500,000 a year. Is it fair for the government to cap CEO bankers' pay? Talk of the Nation, I'm Neil Conan.